and excessive force used against civilians. Rights groups demand that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice.
9 years ago, Israel waged an all-out war in Gaza and committed war crimes. Israel used a tactic of bombing buildings with civilians inside and also attacked United Nations shelters. We have documented the killings and injuring of Palestinian civilians and the mass destruction of civilian infrastructure. We call on international legal bodies, including the International Criminal Court, to investigate the Israeli crimes and to hold the perpetrators accountable.
The 2014 war also saw the bombardment of thousands of homes and the displacement of around 500,000 people. The Israeli regime has consistently failed to make any attempt to hold individuals at any level responsible for the war crimes and crimes against humanity.
I was injured and my 60-year-old son was killed. 3 of my cousins were also killed. My family, along with 10 other families, were hiding in the basement when it was hit by an Israeli rocket.
During the 2014 war, the Israeli regime displayed callous indifference, launching attacks on family homes in the densely populated coastal strip. This is while the United States and other Western countries provided billions of dollars worth of military aid to the Israeli regime during and after the 2014 onslaught on Gaza.
The Israeli regime has shown zero accountability for the crimes perpetrated by its troops due to the protection it enjoys from the international community, especially from the United States. These actions encourage Israel to commit more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Experts say that the Israeli regime has committed acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip since 2008. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cluster bombs, which the administration of United States President Joe Biden recently classified as a war crime, will now be sent to Ukraine in Washington's latest escalation of the unrest. Cluster munitions are banned by over half the world because they release dozens of bomblets, which often remain unexploded for decades after a conflict has ended. They cause more casualties among civilians than among combatants, and the United States is sending bombs with the imprecise grenades used in the 1991 invasion of Iraq. From bombing irrigation dams in Korea to Agent Orange in Vietnam to using chemical weapons against Iranians, the United States and their Western partners continue to use tactics which the global majority often finds immoral, even during wartime.
These are omnicide weapons. They're the worst atrocities in history, each in a can. Do reduce any sense of our moral authority in this war. Since we're not in this to protect civilians, we're not in this to protect Ukrainians, who we've maneuvered into being our foot soldiers and into dying for American interests while America doesn't sit comfortably at home.
With diplomacy off the table and Kiev's long-awaited counteroffensive a failure, Washington admitted that they are sending the bombs because they are running out of traditional ammunition.
Because of the dramatically high expenditure rates of artillery by Ukraine and by Russia, where we need to build a bridge from where we are today to when we have enough monthly production of unitary rounds. This is the moment to begin the construction of that bridge so that there isn't any period over this summer or heading into this fall when Ukraine is short on artillery.
Escalation is reaching such levels that some analysts in Russia are actually advocating the use of nuclear weapons against Western Europe as the only way to restore the fear of war among Western leaders and to finally end the 9-year conflict in Ukraine. The United States used similar logic against Japan in World War II.
Our government says that stresses that Russia has been using cluster bombs through the war. Russian President Putin is, if anything, unpopular in his country to the extent that he's the most popular politician there. But he gets grief for having gone into Ukraine too soft in an attempt not to kill the civilians that ultimately this civil war has been about. It's been a pogrom by Kiev and by ethnic Ukrainians in the west of the country against its east.
NATO members will meet next week in Lithuania, where many fear an even more significant expansion of the war will be announced. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Outside Israel's London embassy, thousands of pro-Palestine protesters vented their anger over Israel's raid in the Jenin refugee camp in occupied Palestine. Speakers condemned not only Israel's crimes, but the ongoing support Britain offers to Tel Aviv.
The horrific footage which is coming out of occupied Palestine by the hour and going viral on social media has sent shockwaves across the globe. These protesters have come out in large numbers here in London to vent their anger and to condemn the British authorities for their so-called complicity in the Israeli crimes against the occupied Palestinian people.
Protest organisers called Israel's assault on the refugee camp barbaric and urged the UK government to abandon plans to outlaw anti-Israel boycott campaigns, including the BDS movement.
It singles out Israel for special treatment, for protection from accountability, which is completely shameful. Why list one country and say, no matter what government is in place, that Israel should not be boycotted? The bill is dangerous on so many fronts. It should never have been brought forward, and it will be shameful if the UK passed this bill.
There is no such right as the right to self-defense for an occupying power. The Palestinian people who have been fighting occupation and fighting for liberation are the ones that have the right to defend themselves. And this is nothing but a justification and a deflection from Israeli perpetual violence against the Palestinians.
Israel and Gaza exchanged fire Wednesday as Israel's regime pulled out from their two-day raid on the camp. At least 12 Palestinians have been killed, many just teenagers. The Palestinian Red Cross said around 3,000 have been forced to flee their homes to escape the violence. Despite the killings, the UK remains committed to pursuing the anti-BDS bill, making it harder for critics of Israel to support Palestine in Britain. Robert Carter, London.
After decades of activism and art, the collection that has been a lifetime in the making was unveiled. Sandra Wafter's Nakba, Palestinians' Ongoing Dispossession.
I thought it's time to go full circle and try and tap into another form, another method of educating people on the Palestinian flight, because 75 years on, it's still unrelenting, unremitting, as we've seen a couple of days ago in Jenin camp. The onslaughts just carry on relentlessly. And one tries in any way, every way, to shed light on this.
The launch of the collection has come amidst growing tensions in the region. This after a violent Israeli incursion into the Jenin refugee camp, resulting in the killings of yet more Palestinians.
The one key word here is ongoing. The Nakba never, ever ended. It just stops and starts, but there is always strife, there is always oppression, there is always colonizing, there is always land theft. It just does not stop. So I just really look forward to the day when we can have a commemoration of the Nakba, because it would finally mean that it's ended, and this hasn't happened yet.
Wafter's work is visceral and emotive, but the artist wants to impart a message that goes beyond the gallery and into the very corridors of power.
You would think that the authors of our dispossession would hold for a minute and reconsider and consider standing on the right side to restitute this problem, this huge catastrophe that they have created. In fact, they are doubling down on shielding Israeli atrocities. It's very shameful, actually. 107 years now since the Balfour Declaration is just ridiculous. Britain has a chance to redress the extreme travesty of justice that it has birthed instead of going the other way and doubling down on shielding war crimes, in effect.
Artists like Sandra Wafter know the value their craft can make in keeping the memories of the Nakba front and center.
Art is powerful.
It can evoke memories of a particular place or a moment in time. It can also be an exemplary tool of resistance. And for artists who are concerned and focused with justice for the Palestinians, well, their message is so important, more important than ever before. The collection, Nakba, Palestinians' Ongoing Dispossession, is available now. Amina Taylor, London.
As the Israeli regime's biggest attack on Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank fails to weaken the Palestinian resistance factions, solidarity gatherings continue to take place in Lebanon and other parts of the world. Hamas representative in Lebanon has told Press TV that the Palestinian people have taken the decision to resist until the occupied territories are liberated and there is no turning back.
The Palestinian people have made up their mind that they will face the Israeli military machine with all courage and that they will continue until they remove the occupation, not only from the West Bank, but from all of Palestine. What is happening today in Jenin is a smaller version of what is happening on all of Palestine. If this superior military machine of the Israelis is incapable of facing a small refugee camp, then how would it face Gaza or the entire West Bank?
Lebanese people who have gathered in several parts across the country in a show of solidarity with the Palestinians say they have also lived through decades of Israeli aggressions against Lebanon, and they believe that resistance is the sole way to end the occupation, as was the case in Lebanon.
There is no other way to face the Israeli occupation than to continue to resist. The Palestinian people tried all means in order to liberate their land. It was a fiasco. So we need now to consolidate the resistance approach and to have a wider solidarity with this resistance, Palestinian resistance, in the occupied territory.
With the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian, they are trying to do that aggression over and over again. And the Palestinian people, starting from Jenin, trying to liberate first Jenin, but I think it will spread all over Palestine and probably it will go way abroad.
Jenin camp reflects the real bloody face of the Israeli occupation, the loss of innocent lives, the destruction of homes, the displacement of big families. There are the realities that the Israeli occupation can't ignore anymore. Today we are gathering together in a public space to send a powerful message for the Palestinian people and for the resistance that we are showing our unity and we are showing our position against the violence, injustice, and the silence in the world.
As you enter any refugee camp in Lebanon, you are greeted with posters for martyrs. And refugees there express their unwavering support for resistance fighters inside Palestine.
We are not in solidarity with Jenin. We are one with Jenin. We, the Palestinians in the diaspora and inside Palestine, are one entity, and what is happening inside Jenin is a step towards the liberation of Palestine and a step towards our return to Palestine. What we saw in Jenin gives us hope that liberation is near.
We've become used to their crimes. They bargained that the old generation is gone, but they were stunned how the new generation is even more steadfast and courageous and ready to face them.
After 2 days of Israeli attacks on Jenin, at least 12 Palestinians were killed and dozens more were injured.
The United Nations says it is alarmed at the scale of Israel's assault on Jenin, yet people of Lebanon and Palestine who have witnessed firsthand decades of Israeli atrocities say there is nothing alarming about the aggression. However, they all have a collective conviction that the resistance will turn victorious. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Out of the classrooms and under the streets, hundreds of thousands of schoolteachers here and across England on strike for 48 hours this week in what's become a battle for dignity and better wages.
We want to be with our children. We really do. You know, it's coming towards the end of term. We want to enjoy every day with them. But at the same time, we recognise that the fight for children's future has to involve strike action because this government doesn't listen.
There are others who are listening. Parents and students.
These strikes have to happen. Obviously, they're impacting in the short term, but with extra pay, teachers will be more motivated and they can help in the long run rather than them withering out.
And withering out they are. Underfunded and overworked, the teachers are not just striking, they're leaving the profession. Jillian Keegan, who runs the Department of Education, says the government has made a fair and reasonable pay offer to teachers. Yet her department has refused to publish recommendations for allegedly a higher pay offer by the Independent School Teachers Review Body, a decision that unions say risks dragging out the current dispute.
Part of the argument here is how a pay rise should be paid for. The government says schools should use their existing budgets to fund any pay increases. But the teachers have been pushing back, saying the school budgets are already stretched and that any wage rise should be fully funded by the government.
And it's not just the teachers' unions who aren't being heard. Also, workers across the public sector, such as transport and health, who have supported each other over the months. Solidarity that has scared the government into responding with a set of draconian laws to make it difficult for strikes to take place. In an atmosphere of uncertainty and with inflation still high, the strikers here are defiant, saying they will push ahead with industrial action until their demands are met. Saeed Bourizza, London.
The burning of the Holy Quran in Sweden has ignited a protest in the capital Sana'a, where U.S. and Israeli flags were set on fire in the streets. Protesters also denounced the latest military operations by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Members of the Palestinian-based Islamic Jihad resistance movement also attended the rally. They called on the Muslim world to unite and counter the Israeli occupying forces.
We came out to tell the world that we are with Palestinians and with Jenin refugee camp, and we are ready to support them. We in Yemen are ready to go to war with the Israeli enemy, who only seems to understand the language of war and violence.
We came out today to call on the Muslim world to defend the Holy Quran and to support the Palestinian cause, which is the Muslim cause. This is an obligation for Muslims to strive and revive and unite against the enemies of Allah.
Some observers believe Israelis, along with the West, have a hand in promoting those who insult Islam.
The individuals who burned the Holy Quran or who insulted Islam represent the aspirations and stance of the West, which promotes the burning of Quran and protects those who engage in such activities even on the Eid holiday. This is done just to insult Muslims worldwide. We will no longer stay silent.
Many Yemeni protesters we spoke with expressed their willingness to go to war with the Israeli regime and any state that supports insulting Muslims' holy book or occupying Muslim holy lands.
Israeli officials say the military operations in Jenin aim to strike what they call a terrorist hub in the occupied West Bank city. Now the protesters here say the Muslim world should become united against what they describe the terrorist Israeli regime. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Cluster bombs are banned by over 100 countries in the world due to their deadly effects. Now, they pose a high risk to civilian populations, and when the bomb explodes, smaller bomblets are released and can hit anyone. Many of these smaller bomblets remain unexploded for years before detonating. And some of these cluster bombs resemble toys, which have made them especially deadly for children. Now, with all of that information, why would the U.S. not listen to the will of over 100 countries and decide to send this illegal weapon to Ukraine? Stay with us as we take a look at that question and others on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests now to the program. Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the LaRouche organization out of Germany. Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute out of Texas. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Germany with Harley. I mean, why do you think that Washington is refusing to abide by the will of the majority of countries in the world to ban cluster bombs?
One is desperation. The Ukrainian counteroffensive is going nowhere. Biden has staked his reelection chances on success in Ukraine, and the inability to turn the situation around is causing a panicked reaction. Biden's excuse is because Ukraine is running out of weapons, and so are the NATO allies. Well, if that's the excuse, what happens when you run out of cluster bombs? You're going to start using tactical nuclear weapons. But the second reason is I think, the more important one. The United States is not abiding by international law. The idea of the rules-based order that the snake oil salesman Antony Blinken is running around the world talking about is a fake bunch of rules that basically are dictated by the United States to preserve the United States as a unipolar superpower. And that people are seeing through that now. The Global South is rising up against it. The resistance to that is clear every day, the de-dollarization and so on. So the U.S. feels compelled to have a show of force. But this actually is a sign of weakness, and I think they're going to regret making this decision. As you pointed out, there's an international convention, a treaty on cluster munitions, where even 21 out of 27 European Union states signed it, and 18 out of the 26 NATO members signed it. So,
okay. All right, stay with me. Yeah. Let me get Daniel in on this discussion. Daniel, cluster bombs are dangerous, and civilians are especially vulnerable when they break up into smaller parts, flying and hitting anyone, as well as when they don't explode and last for years before detonating. How can Washington justify sending or using this type of weapon and at the same time play the human rights card with other countries over and over?
Well, the U.S. does hypocrisy pretty well. The U.S. government, I should say, does hypocrisy very well. And I agree with everything my colleague said, by the way. I think he made some very good points. The real issue, though, these cluster munitions will be put in 155-millimeter shells. These are not the kinds of huge bombs that the U.S., for example, dropped over Laos and Cambodia in the 70s. Ironically enough, they'll be less effective in the battlefield because there aren't these massive bombs that are being dropped. So they actually will have less effect in the battlefield. President Biden just said it outright. We're running out of weapons, and this is all we have left. It's a temporary measure. And indeed, as you suggest, it really is thrumming your nose at international conventions. But most interestingly, I think, this is the first we've seen of real cracks in the so-called Western alliance against Russia. Because as you point out earlier, the majority of the U.S.'s NATO partners have not only signed the international convention, but have passed domestic laws outlawing the use of or provision of such weaponry, and also the same is true in the EU. So you're seeing the U.S. going against its allies. We've already seen cracks in the alliances anyway. You're seeing a lot of restiveness. If you look in Germany, for example, you're seeing the rise of the AfD party. You're seeing the rise in France of the Le Pen National Party. So you're seeing a lot of these things happening, bubbling up. And to that, as the neocons will do, they lit a match and poured in some fire. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
Well, Harley, you heard what Daniel said about American allies expressing their dissatisfaction with the U.S. decision. But tell me, do they not have any say at all in what Washington do? I mean, if they're a close ally. Tell me about that side of things.
Well, first of all, let me just simply say, it's good to be on with Daniel. It's been a while since we've spoken. The points you made were quite important, but the question you're asking, when did the European allies stand up to the United States and the United Kingdom so far in this situation? The perfect example is Germany. Germany's energy supply was destroyed by the attack on the Nord Stream pipeline. As Seymour Hersh pointed out, and no one's really refuted Hersh, this was done by Biden or by the United States, and the Germans refused to raise a peep about it. That's why the AfD the conservative, the nationalist party in Germany is making gains because people see no one in Germany defending national interests. The same thing in France. French society is splitting apart. The Dutch government just fell. The European countries have been silent and have served as vassals to an Anglo-American war machine. And unfortunately, there are very few people on the political scene that are standing up against this. And that's the most important thing, is the people have to get out and be heard. We really do need not just an anti-war movement, but a movement against the military-industrial complex, which is controlling politics in every single one of these countries of NATO, the Five Eyes, and the United States.
Well, Daniel, the Russian embassy in Washington has condemned the U.S. for sending the banned cluster munitions to Ukraine. The embassy has written that the White House has confessed to committing the war crimes by admittingly sending these illegal weapons to Ukraine. So what's going to happen? So that they have admitted to doing this. So now what? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it really speaks to the bloodthirstiness of the American neocons who are running the show right now, because we know that these munitions are going to kill some Russians, but they're also going to kill a lot of Ukrainians when they retreat, as they have been doing. It's going to be blood all around. But the other issue is that the Russians have been restrained thus far in the use of these types of munitions, but they have millions of them in their arsenal. So I think their response is going to be, okay, so that's how the game is played now. Well, we have plenty of those to go around as well. And so who suffers the most? Well, these are the Ukrainians who are getting plucked off the streets and literally kidnapped by the government, had a gun forced into their hands. Some of these are not of military age, let's be honest. I mean, they'll get a guy like me and put a gun in his hand, God forbid. But this is what's happening, and they're getting out there and getting blown up. So the callousness of U.S. foreign policy is really astonishing, and I think the world is waking up and seeing it slowly. Not quickly enough, but slowly but surely.
Well, based on what you've said, Daniel, do you think that gradually the mainstream media story about basically that Ukraine is winning, is that starting to crack? Is that starting to fall apart? Are the pieces being put together, you think, or not for people?
Well, the sentient people do understand this, but the mainstream media is far from sentient. We have government media in America, and that's it. We have government media and semi-independent media. But it's very obvious to any person with a couple of brain cells that if the Ukraine is winning narrative is the narrative, then why are you even admitting that you're scraping the bottom of the barrel for these weapons, because we don't have any more? Like, these two don't go together. It's impossible for both. It's, you know, it's, yeah, it's like 1984. You can't have two opposing thoughts at the same time.
Yeah, well, what do you make of, Harley, what do you make of Biden's comments? I mean, saying that basically it was a hard decision, but running out of munitions. I mean, it's so odd for a party to say that in a war, but then at the same time try to continue the narrative that the spring offensive, or I guess the summer offensive now, is successful.
I'm not sure we can make much of a judgment on Biden's mental state. You know, between tripping over sandbags and tripping over his own tongue, what he says is actually not so important. What's important is what they're doing in his name. Now, remember, a couple of years ago when Psaki was his press secretary, she said use of cluster bombs are a war crime. Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, well, we're using them. So the hypocrisy is so clear, and I think most of the world is waking up. The question is, what will wake up the sleeping giants, the populations in the United States and Western Europe? And you know, seeing Biden making such contradictory statements doesn't create a lot of confidence in American leadership. So how do you, on the one hand, assert America is the sole superpower and can make all the rules, and then it's making rules that go against international treaties? It's not going to last for much longer, and the question really is what happens after this war is over. And I think people are beginning to get the point that Ukraine is not going to win, Ukraine is not going into NATO, and we're going to soon find out exactly how bloodthirsty the Ukrainian leadership is by going along with this proxy war. They're killing their own people. Daniel said it. Who's going to die from these cluster bombs? It will be Ukrainians. Some of them will be Russian ethnics. Many of them will be Ukrainian nationals. They're going to be the victims of this decision.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Daniel, I mean, when the West has sent hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons to Ukraine, which has not led to its victory, does it really think the cluster bombs are going to turn the tide? Or is it simply that they want to inflict as much harm as possible? I'm trying to get an understanding of this.
Well, the one thing that's very interesting, if you look at U.S. military spending, we spend more than the next eight or nine countries, I forget what it is now, combined, right? We spend well over $1.5 trillion a year when all combined together on military spending. Yet, I think Americans might start thinking, especially middle class and working class Americans who are really getting hit hard with our economic downturn, they may ask, why do we have to spend $1.5 trillion a year, shovel a couple hundred billion of it over to Ukraine, and you're telling them we don't have any weapons? Well, where the heck does the money go? It's supposed to buy weapons. Where's it going? And I think hopefully they'll scratch their head and they'll look around at some of the mansions around the Beltway in Washington, D.C., and understand this is an absolute massive Ponzi scheme, whereas the rich are preying upon the poor in America and handing them a flag in return. Hey, wave this. You're patriotic. Now give me your money. Hopefully that won't last much longer.
Well, Harley, you mentioned something earlier in the program about basically, when Biden said he had no choice but to send Kiev the cluster bombs because they were running low. And you mentioned, well, let's look at this, because based on that logic then, perhaps they feel like nuclear weapons would be next. I mean, if there's no limits, which obviously there seems to be no limits here, that they are sending these illegal munitions now, I mean, I would think that there would be such fear actually in the whole world with hearing this statement. I mean, your take, Harley.
Well, you have to realize that there are people in the Pentagon planning and in the intelligence community who have been gaming out the idea of how to win a limited nuclear war, that there are documents that have been prepared over the years and updated, and this idea of almost $1 trillion going into the defense budget. They are planning on how they think they can overcome what are, at this point, disadvantages. The U.S. is terribly unprepared for a war against China, and yet we're pushing it aggressively. We've seen this question of running out of weapons. You know, the British defense minister said if Britain ended up in a war, if NATO ended up in a war with Russia, they'd run out of ammunition in less than a week. And yet they're flexing the muscles and threatening the Russians and poking them in the eye as much as they can. One provocation after another. It's a classic case of the emperor has no clothes. The question is, who will stand up and say that? Why is there no one in the U.S. Congress? There are a couple of people, actually, who have raised this, including some Democrats and Republicans. But why is there not a massive outcry against this kind of policy? And it's a pure sign, a clear sign, that Biden is not mentally competent to serve as president and commander-in-chief.
Well, Daniel, what about that? Who is going to stand up? Let's look at the European side, because they have the most to lose. I mean, they're the closest to the war zone. And as Harley just said, with the UK basically saying they probably would have enough weapons for a week if they got into a war with Russia, how likely are we going to see more of a split between the Europeans and the Americans on this as this continues?
Well, hopefully not much longer, but the European leadership has sure shown itself willing to be a punching bag of Washington. We'll see how long that lasts. But, you know, the other important component of this is you suggested people on Capitol Hill. Within Biden's own party, this is the first time we've seen a split among people that have backed Biden's war, who we might be surprised that we're backing this war because they've had careers as anti-war members of the Progressive Caucus when there's a Republican in office. They've backed this war. But there's something about cluster munitions, and maybe it's because Princess Diana and all of these campaigns against them, they have a different tone. Yeah, depleted uranium is awful. Let's not be in joke about it, but there's something about cluster munitions, cluster bombs. It's such a horrible thought comes to mind that you're seeing people from the president's own party saying, hey, this is a step too far. And that's dangerous for him because he's lost his European allies in the majority on this. He is losing his allies on the Democrat side. Now, most of the Republicans are brain dead. They want to do more. Lindsey Graham wants to have nuclear war tomorrow. That's different. But when you're starting to see cracks in his own Democratic coalition, hey, that's a bridge too far, Mr. President, then I think you're seeing some desperation. And I'm starting to wonder whether, as my colleague Harley points out, that the president does seem to have some deficits upstairs. Maybe they're looking for a way to ease Biden out, and this might be the thing they're using. Who knows?
Right. Well, because one would think that prior to making such an important decision, Harley, that there would be a lot of assessment of the pluses and the minuses and other choices. I mean, is that not the case in the Biden cabinet? Or is it simply that the neocons are ruling and this is what they want and that's the way it is?
I think you're giving too much credit to the people in the Biden cabinet. If you look at the key proponents of this war, people like Blinken, Sullivan, these are corrupt people. Blinken, between his service under the Obama administration and then coming back in under Biden, set up a consulting firm that made tens of millions of dollars working with the war machine. The defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, is a board member of Raytheon. You know, to the extent they are mentally competent, they're looking at this as money-making and reasserting American hegemony. Are there people who can think? Maybe on lower levels you have some people who would say something, but look what happens when there are whistleblowers. The Ellsberg case comes to mind. The Julian Assange case comes to mind. If you're in the establishment on the inside and you raise questions too strongly, you're facing being charged under the Espionage Act, going to jail for the rest of your life, having a kangaroo court frame-up. So I think between the corruption and the fear, and also just the plain venality and stupidity of these cabinet officials, Avril Haines, by the way, who's the National Intelligence Director, also worked with Blinken and this West exec consulting firm. So, you know, the United States has lost it. The Democratic Party, which used to be anti-war and free speech, is now the party of suppression of free speech and pro-war. So we've seen a dramatic shift downward in U.S. political thinking. But I think when you see that Daniel and I are in essential agreement on this, we're seeing people from the libertarians, from the left, the right. We're starting to see the emergence of a potential peace movement internationally. But it's got to come together really quickly.
Well, Daniel, now Russia has talked about all of this, that basically it shows an act of desperation on the part of the United States and signals its weakness. Your perspective on that?
I think it's pretty obvious that that's the case. You know, that the U.S. Remember, at first we were going to only send helmets because we didn't dare even send a pistol. That's how it started. But the neocons have no reverse gear. They only know how to escalate. But each escalation, remember, each wonder weapon, send us javelins, Saint Javelin, it did nothing. Send us HIMARS. HIMARS didn't have any strategic effect on the battlefield. And the Russians soon figured out how to block them, you know, and this sort of thing. And the drones they've been able to get rid of. The tanks now, they've lost 25% of their Bradley of armored vehicles, according to the U.S. military. So none of these wonder weapons are making a difference on the battlefield, and that's because to the Russians, this is an existential war. They were reluctant to enter this war. You know, Putin spent years from 2007 in Munich, he spent years saying, guys, stop doing this. This is not necessary. Don't keep pushing it, and nobody listened. They basically, what happens in Washington is they believe their own rhetoric. Russia is weak. Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. It goes on, and they believe what they say. And so when it happens, it turns out that, gosh, that's actually not the truth. When you're fighting for what you believe is your very existence, then you happen to fight a little bit better than the others.
Right. Well, Harley, what is it going to take to end these double standards and end this rule-based international order that basically allows Washington to do whatever it wants and to create so much havoc in the world without having to answer to it?
Well, I think what you're dealing with is this question of the delusional nature of the political leadership who may actually believe the narratives that are being put out by the mainstream media. But reality is going to assert itself. The fact that they've run out of ammunition, that's reality. You can promise all the weapons you want, but if you can't produce them, what happens? If Ukraine is consistently pushed back with their offensive, you can say the counteroffensive is going to succeed, but reality is saying something different. And now we're seeing a new factor brought in, which is the global south. Blinken went around Africa and tried to bully African leaders to support the isolation of Russia. And they just told him, you can't come here and tell us what to do. We're a sovereign nation. Mm-hmm. And I think we're starting to see a shift where around the world people are beginning to realize that the emperor has no clothes and that sovereignty is the name of the game. But that, by the way, is what's happening in Europe with the Le Pen movement, with the AfD in Germany. Maloney's been a real catastrophe so far in Italy, but some of the people behind her are trying to break out of that. So I think the future is going to rest with those countries that put the idea of the sovereign needs of their nation and their people first. And at some point that will force a change, either that or the complete smashing of Ukraine by the Russian military if Putin lets up a little bit of his restraint.
Okay, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. Out of Potsdam, Germany, Harley Schlanger, spokesman of LaRouche Organization, Lake Jackson, Texas, Daniel McAdams, executive director, Ron Paul Institute. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The latest official statistics published in Britain shows that the rate of inflation is still higher than the forecast of economic experts and the Bank of England, and that Britain's economy is not doing so well compared to other European countries. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak recently admitted the number of British people with fixed mortgages means that spiking interest rates are taking longer to control rampant inflation. Giving evidence to senior MPs, the Prime Minister hinted that misery for homeowners might need to last longer. Stressing his vow to halve the rate of price rises this year, Rishi Sunak also poured cold water on public sector pay demands and hopes of tax cuts. The comments came as Sunak made his twice-yearly appearance before the powerful Commons Liaison Committee this afternoon. Rishi Sunak claimed the government remains committed to bringing inflation down, with his pledge of halving the Consumer Price Index this year, a step on the way to getting it back down to the Bank of England's 2% target. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak indicated that restraint on spending was going hand in hand with the Bank of England's action on interest rates. Sunak said pushing up interest rates was making a small number of people do all the heavy lifting because so many had fixed mortgage rates, adding, there are lots of different transmission mechanisms. Rishi Sunak noted, you're right about the transmission mechanism being perhaps slower when it comes to mortgages than it has been in the past because of the preponderance of people to have at least short-term fixed-rate mortgages now. He added, but as I say, the mortgage aspect of it is just one of the many transmission mechanisms of the monetary policy. Prime Minister Sunak also delivered a tough message on demand for big public sector pay awards and borrowing to fund tax cuts. He said, fiscal policy is making sure our borrowing is responsible, our approach to public sector is responsible. If we get those things wrong, that makes the inflation situation even worse. Rishi Sunak batted away questions about whether banks are passing on the benefit interest rate rises to savers, saying, as he fully supports a review by the regulator. He also stressed that the Charter for Mortgage Holders provides support and relief for those in financial trouble. Anger has been growing at allegations that food and fuel costs are being kept high as retailers bolster their profits. Banks are facing fury and spiking interest rates are being immediately passed on to mortgagers, but saving rates are lagging far behind. The average five-year fixed mortgage topped 6% in recent days, inflicting more pain on homeowners. Regulators are looking at whether there is evidence of profiteering across different industries, and drivers will be able to see how pump prices vary across the country as part of a new transparency push. British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. A leading economist warned that Britain's base rate could be raised as high as 7% to tackle stubbornly high inflation, hitting stretch mortgage holders even harder. Alan Monks of JP Morgan Chase said some indicators suggest the Bank of England's key interest rate would have to rise a further 2 percentage points as prices continue to climb. It's only 2 weeks since the base rate was hiked by 0.5 percentage point to 5% to bring inflation under control, leaving homeowners struggling to meet their rising loan repayments. Financial markets are expecting the Bank of England to increase the base rate above 6% by the end of this year, and his remarks heighten fears for Britain's economy and household budgets. The average five-year fixed-rate mortgage deal has jumped above 6% for the first time since November, and mortgage holders were warned that fixed-rate deals could jump to 7% this summer. According to financial data experts, MoneyFacts, a typical five-year home loan has risen from 5.97% to 6.01%. The average two-year fixed-rate mortgage has gone from 6.42% to 6.47%. Some experts have urged the Bank of England to rethink the use of out-of-control interest rates to tame inflation, fearing that rising interest rates could tip the economy into recession. Alan Monks of JP Morgan Chase wrote that a hard landing for Britain's economy looks increasingly likely, but his central forecast is for a moderate peak rate of 5.75 percentage points in November. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has announced that Britain is the only G7 country where inflation is rising. JP Morgan Chase warned that surging borrowing costs could hit business confidence and drive up unemployment in Britain. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research estimated last month that 1.2 million British households would become insolvent this year as a result of higher mortgage payments. But savers have been trying to make the most of rising interest rates, which have led some banks to offer saving rates as high as 6%, their highest level in at least a decade, albeit still behind inflation, which is currently at 8.7%, against a target of 2%. Grilled by MPs on the liaison committee, the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak refused to say whether he would hit his target of halving inflation by the end of this year, but he vowed to just keep throwing everything at it.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.